We would like to send out a special thanks to our new sponsor, Wink, for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Wink is offering our audience members who are over 21 and live in the U.S. a $22 credit plus free shipping on their first order of 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Wink. So please visit trywink.com/cold. That's trywinc.com/cold. Thank you and enjoy the show. October 21st, 1978. Cape Otway, Australia. After leaving on a seemingly routine training flight in a Cessna 182 aircraft, 20-year-old Frederick Valentich vanishes without explanation over the Bass Strait. During a radio transmission, Valentich describes seeing an unidentified flying object, and his final words are, "It's hovering, and it's not an aircraft." When independent eyewitnesses corroborate seeing strange things in the sky in the area that night, speculation mounts that Valentich's disappearance might have been the result of an alien encounter. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to a special Halloween episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we will be going back down under to Australia to cover one of the most infamous unsolved mysteries of all time, the 1978 disappearance of Frederick Valentich. Throughout the month of October, our podcast has been covering creepy stories which have a bit of a Halloween slant to them, and for our final episode this month, I thought it only appropriate that we cover our very first mystery about potential UFO involvement. Now, while I personally find UFO stories fascinating, I know that not everyone likes them, which is why I've never featured one on the podcast before. But this story is different because regardless of what your stance is on UFOs, a man still went missing under mysterious circumstances and has not been found to this day. A while back, I talked about this case in the Trail Went Cold's Facebook discussion group, and the responses seemed to indicate that even the most hardened skeptics would be interested in seeing this mystery featured on the podcast. And I've got my own personal reason for wanting to cover it. Frederick Valentich's disappearance actually took place on the very day I was born. If you type October 21st, 1978 into Google, this is constantly cited as not only the most famous mystery, but the most famous event, period, to take place on this particular date. So I guess that can only mean I was predestined to grow up having an obsession with unsolved mysteries. Anyway, before we get started, just a brief reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which alternates between our regular full-length episodes and shorter minisodes. We deliver either a new full-length episode or a new minisode every Wednesday. We're currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unexplained disappearance of Frederick Valentich. Our story begins in Australia in 1978. Our central figure is 20-year-old Frederick Valentich, who hails from an Italian family and has numerous siblings. Valentich lives in Melbourne and has aspirations of a career in aviation. He has spent 3 years as a cadet in the Royal Australian Air Force Air Training Corps and is currently employed by Southern Air Services in the Melbourne suburb of Moorabbin. At this point, Valentich has 150 hours of total flight time and a Class 4 instrument rating. He has a private pilot's license and is studying to obtain a commercial pilot's license so that he can become a commercial airline pilot. At 6:19 on the evening of October 21st, Valentich climbs into a single-engine Cessna 182L light aircraft and takes off from Moorabbin Airport for what promises to be a 235-kilometer training flight. His plan is to travel west alongside the Australian coast for about 40 minutes before turning south at Cape Otway and heading across Bass Strait for about an hour before arriving at King Island. On the surface, this seems to be nothing more than a routine straightforward flight. However, at 7:06 p.m., Valentich was flying over Bass Strait near Cape Otway when Steve Roby, a flight service officer at Melbourne Airport, received a radio call from him. Here is a recreation of their conversation based on the original transcript.
Melbourne, this is Delta Sierra Juliet. Is there any known traffic below 5,000 feet?
Delta Sierra Juliet, no known traffic.
Delta Sierra Juliet, I am. Seems to be a large aircraft below 5,000 feet.
Delta Sierra Juliet, what type of aircraft is it?
Delta Sierra Juliet, I cannot affirm. It's four bright. It seems to me like landing lights.
Delta Sierra Juliet.
Melbourne, this is Delta Sierra Juliet. The aircraft has just passed over me at least 1,000 feet above.
Delta Sierra Juliet, roger, and it is a large aircraft, confirmed?
Unknown. Due to the speed it's travelling. Is there any Air Force aircraft in the vicinity?
Delta Sierra Juliet, no known aircraft in the vicinity.
Melbourne, it's approaching now from due east towards me.
Delta Sierra Juliet?
Delta Sierra Juliet, it seems to me that he's playing some sort of game. He's flying over me, 2-3 times at speeds I could not identify.
Delta Sierra Juliet, roger. What is your actual level?
My level is 4,500. 4500.
Delta Sierra Juliet, and you confirm you cannot identify the aircraft?
Affirmative.
Delta Sierra Juliet, roger. Standby.
Melbourne, Delta Sierra Juliet. It's not an aircraft. It is...
Delta Sierra Juliet, can you describe the aircraft?
Delta Sierra Juliet, as it's flying past, it's a long shape. Cannot identify more than it has such speed. It's before me right now, Melbourne.
Delta Sierra Juliet, roger. And how large would the object be?
Delta Sierra Juliet, Melbourne. It seems like it's stationary. What I'm doing right now is orbiting, and the thing is just orbiting on top of me also. It's got a green light, and sort of metallic light. It's all shiny on the outside. Delta Sierra Juliet. It's just vanished.
Delta Sierra Juliet.
Melbourne, would you know what kind of aircraft I've got? Is it a military aircraft?
Delta Sierra Juliet, confirm the aircraft just vanished.
Say again.
Delta Sierra Juliet, is the aircraft still with you?
Delta Sierra Juliet, it's... Now approaching from the southwest.
Delta Sierra Juliet.
Delta Sierra Juliet, the engine is rough idling. I've got it set to 23-24, and the thing is coughing.
Delta Sierra Juliet, roger. What are your intentions?
My intentions are to go to King Island, Melbourne. That strange aircraft is hovering on top of me again. It's hovering, and it's not an aircraft.
A big thanks to my Australian friend Cambo, who provided the voice of Frederick Valentich, and hosts the podcast True Crime Island, which I'll be playing a promo for at the end of the show. Anyway, Valentich's transmission ended at 7:12 p.m., with what sounded like 17 seconds of metallic scraping noises. The actual recording of the conversation between Valentich and Roby has never been publicly released, but excerpts featuring the strange sounds were played on a TV show called The Unexplained Files, and this is what they sounded like. Anyway, this would turn out to be the last time anyone ever heard from Frederick Valentich, and it's hovering, and it's not an aircraft, would be forever etched as some of the most infamous last words of all time. The Cessna never arrived at King Island, and Valentich's final radio transmission escalated into a distress situation 21 minutes later. A massive air and sea search was performed of Bass Strait between Cape Otway and King Island, but failed to turn up any trace of Valentich or his missing aircraft, as there wasn't even any wreckage to be found. The search came to an end on October 25th, 4 days after Valentich went missing. So what could have been the meaning of Valentich's last transmission, and what was this hovering object he was referring to? Well, as you probably guessed, UFOs would immediately enter the discussion, and reports would come pouring in from witnesses who claimed they saw strange objects or lights in the sky along the Australian coast on the night of Valentich's disappearance. But one eyewitness account really stood out. The witness's real name has never been disclosed publicly, but an article from Journal of Scientific Exploration refers to him under the pseudonym Ken Hansen, so that's what I'll call him here. Hansen claimed that on the evening of October 21, 1978, he was traveling to his home in Apollo Bay after an outing with his wife and two nieces, when they saw a lime green light flying through the sky near Cape Otway. According to Hansen, it appeared to be about 1,000 feet above an aircraft, and the light seemed to be performing a steep dive at a 45-degree angle and was moving ever so closer to the aircraft before they both disappeared from view. This sighting would have taken place around the approximate time as Frederick Valentich's final radio transmission. Hansen did not disclose the sighting publicly until years after the fact, when he shared this story with a policeman who subsequently put him in touch with Valentich's father. 6 weeks after Valentich's disappearance, there was another interesting development involving a plumber-slash-amateur photographer named Roy Manifold. He was also present at Cape Otway on the evening of October 21st and took 6 photographs of the sunset approximately 20 minutes before Valentich's radio transmission. While Manifold didn't see or hear anything unusual at the time, but when he developed the photos, he was surprised to find some strange anomalies. The 4th photo appeared to show what looked like a dense black lump on the water, giving the impression that something might have been rising from it. While the 5th photo looked normal, the 6th photo had what appeared to be a strange black mark in the sky. According to Manifold, he had taken thousands of photographs throughout his life, but had never seen anything like this. He ordinarily would have attributed it to nothing more than a developing error, but when he realized the photos were taken on the same night Frederick Valentich disappeared at approximately the same location, he had the negatives delivered to the chief photographer of the newspaper, The Australian, who believed the anomalies were authentic and not a developing error. So the photo of the black object in the sky wound up running on page 1 of the paper, but the Royal Australian Air Force wasted no time at stepping in and dismissing the object as nothing more than a cumulus cloud in its dying stages. This photo was eventually sent to a UFO group in Phoenix called Ground Saucer Watch, who performed a computer analysis and determined that the strange mark was not actually dirt or damage to the negative, but was something which was actually present in the sky while the picture was taken. They believe this black mark was a solid metallic object located about a mile from the camera. It was likely moving through the sky at a speed of approximately 200 miles per hour and was enveloped in a cloud of exhaust. However, many years later, the photograph was given a second analysis, and they had the exact opposite impression, believing the mark was nothing more than a developer's error. Well, what added an extra level of intrigue to the whole UFO angle was that Valentich himself was a major flying saucer enthusiast who told people he had seen a UFO prior to this incident and even expressed concern about UFOs attacking him someday. At one point, Valentich told his father he had seen classified material at a Royal Australian Air Force base which confirmed his belief that UFOs exist. Only 6 days before he went missing, Valentich had even mentioned the possibility of encountering a UFO during a conversation with his girlfriend and told her, "If a UFO landed in front of me right now, I would go in it, but never without you." But even without the UFO angle, there were still a lot of things about the disappearance which didn't add up, such as why he was making this flight to King Island in the first place. Valentich gave two conflicting stories about the purpose of his trip. He told his superiors at Moorabbin Airport that he was picking up passengers at King Island and even brought along 4 life jackets on his trip. However, he told his family and his girlfriend that he was going to pick up some crayfish, even though there was no record of him placing any orders, and crayfish was not even available on King Island on this particular date. Even stranger, Valentich never even told anyone at King Island Airport that he was coming, meaning there wouldn't have been any lights on at the airport that night if Valentich actually arrived. If all this wasn't weird enough, Valentich also told his girlfriend that he was going to meet her at 7:30 p.m. that night, but given that his plane didn't even take off until 6:19 p.m., there's no possible way he would have been able to fly to King Island and back again in time to keep that appointment. Anyway, in 1982, a coronial inquiry was held into Valentich's disappearance and returned an open verdict. Valentich was listed as missing and presumed dead, and he was eventually declared legally dead. On May 16, 1983, an eroded engine cowl flap was found ashore on Flinders Island, which is located in the Bass Strait approximately 320 kilometers away from Cape Otway. The Bureau of Air Safety Investigation concluded that the flap came from a Cessna 182, and it had a number on it which matched one of the serial numbers from Valentich's missing aircraft. The current in Bass Strait was very strong at the time of Valentich's disappearance, so it's not inconceivable that a piece of his plane could have floated over 300 kilometers away. However, it's worth noting that the flap washed up near Flinders Island Airport, and there were 2 Cessnas which had lost parts during takeoff from the airport during the preceding years, so it is possible the flap could have come from there. Valentich's family have wanted to perform modern tests on the flap to determine if it might have been in Bass Strait salt water for 5 years, but it looks like the flap might have either been lost or scrapped, since it cannot be found today. In 1998, Valentich's family erected a memorial plaque at Cape Otway to commemorate the 20th anniversary of his disappearance, and it was unveiled by Flight Service Officer Steve Roby, the last person to ever speak with him. Roby, for his part, has always maintained that Valentich sounded genuine about what he was seeing during their final conversation together. An interesting postscript to this story that not many people know is that only 5 days after Valentich's disappearance, Roby had a similar radio conversation with another light aircraft pilot on a flight through East Sale, who reported being passed 3 times by a bright light traveling at jet speed, which grazed by him so closely that he decided to land his aircraft. Another interesting development took place in 2012. For over 30 years, anyone who wanted to delve into the case was told that the official 315-page file on Valentich's disappearance had been lost or destroyed. But by complete chance, it was discovered by a researcher named Keith Basterfield, who found a digital version of the entire file in an online index of the National Archives of Australia, so anyone from the public can now go to the website to view it. In spite of what you might think, most people don't believe any deliberate attempts were made to cover up the file. In all likelihood, this was all just simple bureaucratic sloppiness, as someone probably just digitized the file and transferred it to the website without realizing its significance. Regardless, even though the file's sudden availability reinvigorated interest in the case, nearly 40 years have passed, and there are still no answers about what actually happened to Frederick Valentich or is missing Cessna 182. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to tell you about our sponsor, Wink, as we are very excited that they are fans of the show. As you probably know, Halloween is just around the corner, and there are so many classic horror movies I like to watch around this time of year, including the original version of Dracula, starring Bela Lugosi, where he utters that famous line, "I never drink wine." Well, I'm sorry to say I gotta strongly disagree with that viewpoint, because I love wine, especially when you have a wonderful company like Wink, who will deliver high-quality wine directly to your doorstep. Wink is targeting a new generation of wine drinkers who want to do away with the pretense and simply enjoy reasonably priced, great wine. Wink custom tailors wines to the tastes of the individual consumer and delivers 3 bottles of wine each month to your doorstep for $39 plus a flat $6 shipping rate. When you visit Wink and take their 20-second palate profile quiz, you'll get instant wine recommendations based on your unique profile. The price point for most wines is $13, so by signing up with Wink, you are getting your first bottle for free. Wink is offering our audience members who are over 21 and live in the US a $20 credit, plus free shipping on your first order of 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Wink. Your wine delivery will be branded Wink. Wink is the wine club associated with Wink. Just the other night, while watching Dracula, in fact, I enjoyed a nice 2016 bottle of Kin & Country Primitivo, which was produced in the Vista Luna Vineyard in Lodi, California. It has a bright, fruity, silky flavor with tasting notes of baking spice, cherry, and mint, and it's very ideal to serve at room temperature with an Italian meal, such as pizza or pasta with red sauce. Wink's website recommended this wine to me after I took their quiz, and they couldn't have been more accurate. And because I ordered from them, I have 3 other bottles of wine which are just as good. This wine also makes an ideal companion while listening to episodes of this podcast, so to receive a $20 credit and free shipping on 4 bottles of wine on your first order, go to trywink.com/cold. That's trywink.com/cold. trywnc.com/cold. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. Well, since this is the first UFO case I've ever covered, this is going to be an interesting analysis. It would be so easy to just cry out, "Aliens!" as the explanation for Valentich's disappearance and leave it at that, but that's not what this podcast is about, so I'm going to try and figure out the most logical explanation I can. Of course, one of the biggest obstacles you'll face when researching UFO stories, or anything paranormal for that matter, is figuring out how reliable the sources are. When you delve into this case online, you're going to find some websites which 100% believe that Valentich was abducted by a UFO, and some of the theories are pretty out there. One of the craziest stories I found was on a blog which claimed that in 1982, a capsule was discovered near the Soviet Union-China border containing a plate with a written message on it from Frederick Valentich, who said he had been captured by aliens so they could recruit him to become a pilot for one of their aircraft. Okay then, well, if this story was true, then those aliens must have had some pretty rotten luck with selecting their candidates, because as I'm about to share with you, Frederick Valentich was a pretty mediocre pilot at best, so they probably would have been better off abducting someone a lot more qualified. Needless to say, there is no credible official source for this story about the capsule and the written message, so I'm just going to ignore it. But the big advantage with analyzing this case, as opposed to other UFO stories, is the 2012 discovery of the digital version of the government file on Valentich's disappearance in the National Archives of Australia. It's pretty much been a godsend for researchers, as it contains official documentation and original newspaper articles about the case, so we have lots of credible sources which can simply focus on the facts rather than the wild conspiracy theories. So before I delve into any theories, I need to provide some backstory about Frederick Valentich's aviation career. Long story short, it wasn't great. It sounds like flying was Valentich's number one passion, and that he really didn't want to do anything else, but unfortunately for him, he was just not very adept at it. He had applied to enlist in the Royal Australian Air Force on two separate occasions, but had been rejected twice because of inadequate educational qualifications. Becoming a commercial airline pilot was his backup plan, but he wasn't having much luck at that either. On two separate occasions, he failed all five commercial license examination subjects. Just 1 month before he went missing, he failed three more commercial license exam subjects, and it would turn out that Valentich had been lying to his family, girlfriend, and several other people about passing these exams. If that wasn't enough, Valentich had some black marks on his flying record, as he had received a warning on one occasion for flying into a controlled zone in Sydney. Not only that, but there were two separate incidents in which Valentich deliberately flew into a cloud, an offense so egregious that he was potentially facing criminal prosecution for this. Because Valentich's prospects of an aviation career seemed to be going down the toilet, there was a lot of speculation that he could have staged his entire disappearance in order to go off and start a new life somewhere, or even staged a very elaborate suicide by deliberately crashing his plane into the water. Due to Valentich's well-documented fascination with UFOs, it was easy for some people to believe that his final radio transmission could have been a hoax in order to make the world believe he had been abducted by aliens. The fact that Valentich was clearly lying about the details of his trip to King Island also added more fuel to this theory. He told conflicting stories about why he was making this trip, and never told King Island Airport about his arrival, so this seemed to suggest that Valentich never had any intention of landing there. At the time of Valentich's final transmission, he would have had enough fuel in his tanks to travel an additional 800 kilometers. Even though it was in his flight plan, there's still some debate about whether Valentich was actually near Cape Otway when he went missing, as this was uncontrolled airspace, so his plane didn't actually show up on radar. There was also a lighthouse keeper in Cape Otway at the time, who should have been directly under Valentich's flight path, but he did not recall seeing or hearing any aircraft that night. But as intriguing as the stage disappearance theory is, this case generated so much publicity that I think if Valentich was alive, some sort of evidence would have surfaced to point to that during these past four decades. And even if Valentich himself managed to disappear successfully, what happened to the Cessna 182? Unless he somehow deliberately crashed the plane into the water and swam to safety, I just don't know how he could destroy an aircraft so thoroughly that no trace of it has ever been found. This seems like a lot of complicated planning for a 20-year-old who, not to insult the guy or anything, was not exactly a super genius. All that being said, however, I wouldn't be 100% against the idea of Valentich fabricating the details about the hovering object over the radio. Remember, this incident was only 1 year removed from the release of Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, one of the biggest Hollywood blockbusters of all time, so UFOs were definitely a hot topic. In fact, Star Wars also came out the previous year, so sci-fi in general was red hot at that time. A few years ago, the Skeptoid podcast released an episode about this case, and the host, Brian Dunning, played audio from a very famous scene in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where an air traffic controller speaks with some commercial airline pilots who believe they have encountered a UFO. When you compare the dialogue in that scene to Valentich's conversation with Steve Roby, there are a lot of similarities in the language. It's been established that Valentich did see Close Encounters, so if he wanted to give off the false impression that he was being abducted by a UFO, maybe he hearkened back to his memories of that scene in order to decide what to say. If Valentich really was planning on suicide, he felt that creating this impression was the best possible way to go out in a blaze of glory, as this would ensure he'd be remembered forever. I know that they conducted an extensive investigation into Valentich's background, and everyone who knew him did not believe he ever would have considered suicide, but it's fairly common for people who show no obvious suicidal tendencies to shock everyone by doing just that. If Valentich's failure to achieve his dream of becoming a successful pilot was just too much for him, who's to say that wouldn't have motivated him to take his own life? The one red flag you really cannot ignore is Valentich's personal obsession with UFOs. I've seen a lot of interviews with people who claim to have had a UFO encounter, and they'll often say that they used to be a complete skeptic, and never believed in UFOs until they actually saw one. But you can't say the same thing about Valentich. Hypothetically, if aliens did come to Earth and abducted Valentich, it seems like one hell of a coincidence that they'd managed to select someone with a devout interest in the subject, who mentioned the possibility of encountering a UFO to his girlfriend only 6 days earlier. Remember, he actually said, "If a UFO landed in front of me right now, I would go in it, but never without you." And I think he actually thought that was some sort of a romantic line. So it's easy to see why a guy like this might be compelled to fabricate a hoax. But unlike some of the other famous incidents where people claim to have been abducted by extraterrestrials, Valentich disappeared. So assuming he wasn't planning to commit suicide, could Valentich have staged the radio transmission because he was planning to disappear for a few days before he returned to tell everyone a fantastic story about how he'd been abducted by aliens? But then something went wrong, and his plane crashed, so he never got a chance to make it that far. Well, in Valentich's defense, Steve Roby has always maintained that he thought Valentich sounded genuinely perturbed during his radio transmission and did not believe he was orchestrating a hoax. And the reason you can't be 100% skeptical about the UFO angle is because there are independent eyewitnesses who could corroborate seeing strange things in the area that night. Of course, you'll see differing accounts from different sources about whether people were seeing things in the sky before or after Valentich's disappearance made the news. But it sounds like a lot of these witnesses reported seeing a fast-moving white light. And during newspaper articles from that time period, the Mount Stromlo Observatory would confirm that this was a peak time period for a meteorite storm, and that they were averaging 10 to 15 sightings per hour of meteorites that night. So maybe that's what many of the witnesses actually saw. However, the one sighting which needs to be addressed is the one from Ken Hansen, because he claimed he saw a green light in the sky that night, which would match the description Valentich gave during his radio transmission. It's true that Hansen never went public with this sighting until years after the fact, when Valentich's account of the green light was already public knowledge. But apparently, on the morning after the incident, Hansen mentioned the green light to his co-workers, and by this point, the details of Valentich's radio transmission had not yet been made public. His co-workers were skeptical of the story, which is why Hansen just decided to drop the subject, and never mentioned it again for years. But if Hansen really did mention the green light at this point, then this lends credence to the idea that he actually saw it, and wasn't just recalling it years after the fact. It seems likely that Hansen and his family are not making this story up about the sighting, because Hansen has always kept his real name out of the spotlight, so it doesn't seem like he's seeking publicity. In fact, when Hansen appeared in an Unsolved Mysteries segment about the story in 1993, he was interviewed in silhouette. And while we're on the subject, here's an interesting piece of trivia about that Unsolved Mysteries segment. During the reenactment where Hansen and his family see the green light, one of his nieces is played by Lisa McCune, who went on to become a pretty famous actress in Australia after starring in the police drama TV series Blue Heelers. So I guess this is pretty much the Australian equivalent of when Matthew McConaughey acted in an Unsolved Mysteries reenactment. Anyway, the alternate explanation for Hansen's sighting is that Valentich's Cessna had a green navigation light on its right wingtip. So if Valentich was flying through the air with his right wingtip up, it could have appeared to Hansen from a distance that this was a separate green light from another aircraft flying above Valentich's Cessna. But the counterpoint to this is that Hansen lived near an airstrip and constantly saw planes taking off at night, so he was fairly knowledgeable about them. So if the green light was nothing more than the navigation light from Valentich's wingtip, there's a good chance he would have been able to spot that. Of course, the UFO theory gained a lot more credence when Roy Manifold took that strange photograph at Cape Otway featuring an unexplained black mark. I know that Ground Saucer Watch analyzed the photo and determined that it was likely a large object flying in the sky, but you have to keep one thing in mind. These guys were a UFO research group, so you can't rule out the possibility that there was some bias present, and they came to this conclusion because they were just seeing what they wanted to see. During the Unsolved Mysteries segment, It was mentioned that a second analysis was performed of the photo years later, and they thought the black mark was nothing more than a developing error. I couldn't really find out much information about this second analysis, or who actually performed it. If this analysis is from a credible source, then I'm willing to believe the simple explanation that it's all just an error. Honestly, if it weren't for Hansen's eyewitness account and Manifold's photograph, it would be a lot easier to discredit the UFO abduction theory, but I personally think it's difficult to debunk either of these pieces of evidence with 100% certainty, so this does add an extra level of intrigue to the story. Of course, the biggest piece of unexplained evidence in this story is the metallic scraping sounds at the end of Valentich's radio transmission. As I stated earlier, while transcripts are available, the actual recording of the transmission has never been released publicly, though I believe it was broadcast on Australian radio once shortly after the disappearance, before it was confiscated by the authorities. In 1979, a copy of the recording was provided to Valentich's father, so he'd be able to hear his son's last words, but he was under strict instructions not to release it. Well, a few years later, he did make a copy for a NASA research scientist named Richard Haynes to analyze. In fact, Haynes was the source of the recording of the metallic sounds you heard earlier in this episode, as he played it while being interviewed on the Unexplained Files TV show. After his analysis, Haynes published his findings in an article for the Journal of UFO Studies, and he thought Valentich could have produced the metallic sounds by keying his microphones pressed to talk switch very quickly. I'm not sure he would have done this on purpose, but Valentich apparently did have a habit of clicking the microphone button after transmitting. He often neglected to put the microphone back on the rack, and had a tendency to activate it by mistake, so that whoever was listening on the other end might hear sounds they weren't supposed to hear. Valentich would sometimes place the microphone on his lap, so the metallic noises simply could have been the sound of him moving the seat forward. So in conclusion, it's possible those 17 seconds of noise might be completely mundane, but because Valentich was never heard from again, their creepiness wound up being amplified. I guess it's possible that Valentich made all those noises himself to add a level of mysteriousness to his final transmission, but regardless of Valentich's intentions, there's one very important question which just hasn't been answered. What happened to the Cessna? Whether you believe Valentich staged his own disappearance or crashed into the water, that still doesn't change the fact that no wreckage has ever been found. The only piece of potential evidence is the engine cowl flap containing one of the Cessna's serial numbers, but it was never conclusively identified as belonging to Valentich's plane. Personally, I've always been on the fence about this one. I know that the current at Bass Strait was very strong, and it's plausible that all the wreckage could have flowed away so far that it was never found by the search teams, but Flinders Island is still 320 kilometers away. Since the flap was found in close proximity to an airport, and it wasn't uncommon for planes to lose parts in the water while taking off, there is a plausible alternate explanation for the flap washing up there. But if Valentich did not crash the plane intentionally, and was 100% genuine about what he was seeing during his radio transmission, how could the Cessna have wound up in the water? Well, one of the most discussed theories is that Valentich became so disoriented that he was flying upside down at the time he was on the radio, and the mysterious object he thought he saw flying overhead was actually nothing more than a reflection of his own plane's lights in the water. When Valentich said the object was hovering over him, this was because he was actually moving closer to his reflection, and he eventually crashed into the water, cutting off his radio transmission. Well, right from the outset, many experts disagreed with this theory, believing that the aircraft would only be capable of flying upside down for about a minute, minute and a half at the most. This is because the fuel tanks were situated in the wings and relied on gravity to feed the motor, and since Valentich's conversation lasted 6 minutes, it seems impossible that the plane could have withstood flying upside down for that length of time. However, one of the most logical theories for Valentich's fate was provided by author Joe Nickel, who is known for being one of the most prominent skeptics in the world, so debunking UFO stories is pretty much his thing. In 2013, Nickel teamed up with a retired U.S. Air Force pilot named James Magaha to provide a thorough review of the Valentich case, and came up with a logical explanation for what might have happened to him, which did not involve UFOs. They concluded that the overhead lights Valentich believed he saw might have actually been the planets Venus, Mars, and Mercury, along with the bright star Antares. These planets would have resembled a diamond shape in the sky, and could have easily been mistaken for lights from a UFO. Valentich was probably so distracted by these so-called UFO lights that he started suffering from spatial disorientation and was deceived by the illusion of a tilted horizon. In response, he inadvertently turned the plane downward and caused it to go into what's called a graveyard spiral. This would decrease the fuel flow and cause the rough idling of the engine which Valentich mentioned during his transmission. Eventually, he would lose all control of the aircraft and crash into the water. Spatial disorientation was also determined to be the cause of the fatal plane crash which took John F. Kennedy Jr.'s life in 1999, as he lost control of his aircraft and suffered a fatal descent into the Atlantic Ocean. These types of crashes generally happen at night or during the early evening, and Valentich did not have much experience flying at night, as his Class 4 instrument rating did authorize him to fly at night, but only in visual, meteorological conditions. While October 21st was a very clear night with perfect weather, Valentich was still a very inexperienced pilot who already had multiple infractions on his record, and, well, as we're about to discuss in a moment, he was probably pretty distracted during this flight. I gotta say, while this theory isn't 100% perfect, there's a lot about it which makes sense. It's also worth noting that Nickel and Magaha were the ones who proposed the idea that the green light Ken Hansen and his family saw in the sky that night was actually the navigation light on the Cessna's wingtip. I'm not sure I find that part of the theory plausible, and I don't think there's ever really been a convincing alternate explanation for the green light. But the fact about their analysis which I find most interesting is their explanation for Valentich's trip that night. There's been so much speculation about why Valentich would lie about his reasons for traveling to King Island, and how the evidence suggests he never intended to go there in the first place. Well, what Nickel and Magaha seem to believe is that Valentich took the Cessna out that night for the express purpose of searching for a UFO. And I actually found that explanation very plausible. Going UFO hunting would be an ideal way for Valentich to accumulate hours in his flying time, but since there's no chance in hell he was going to tell his superiors or his family that, he concocted a false story about traveling to King Island. There's no way of knowing Valentich's exact flight path, or how long he was planning to go search that night, but given that he was facing possible criminal prosecution for the incidents in which he flew through a cloud, there was a distinct possibility he could lose his pilot's license in the future, so he might have figured this would have been one of his only opportunities to go on a UFO hunt. Given Valentich's inexperience at flying at night, if he was preoccupied with finding a UFO and became distracted, you could see how this might wind up as a recipe for disaster. I was initially skeptical about the theory that Valentich could have seen some planets and a star and confused them for lights from a UFO, as I found it unlikely that a professional pilot would make that mistake. But then I said to myself, it's unlikely a professional pilot who wasn't obsessed with UFOs would make that mistake. If the entire purpose of Valentich's flight was to find a UFO, then yes, I can understand how someone in that frame of mind might wind up seeing what they wanted to see and jumped to the wrong conclusion. So it's very plausible that Valentich saw something non-extraterrestrial, but was so certain it was a UFO that he radioed in his sighting. But he became so preoccupied that he began to suffer from spatial disorientation, went into a graveyard spiral, and crashed into the water. Now, if you're wondering why no wreckage has ever been found, just remember that even though it's assumed Valentich was near Cape Otway when his final transmission took place, no one can be 100% certain. He also had lots of fuel left in the Cessna, so if he traveled in another direction, got lost or wandered off course, or just kept flying for a long period of time after the transmission ended, he could have crashed well outside the area which was searched, and with the strong currents in Bass Strait, all the evidence might have flowed away into an area where no one could find it. So while I can't 100% explain Ken Hansen's sighting of the green light, or the strange anomaly in Roy Manifold's photograph, I do think it's most likely there were no UFOs, and that Frederick Valentich and his missing Cessna are simply submerged at an unknown location. All that being said, I'm pretty open-minded, and don't consider myself a complete skeptic when it comes to UFOs and aliens. I'd really like to find out that extraterrestrials are real, and that Frederick Valentich is piloting one of their spacecraft somewhere, but I have to follow logic here and concede that it's a lot more plausible that a pilot with a fascination with UFOs just got so caught up in his obsession that he died in a tragic accident. Until the day he died, Frederick's father, Guido Valentich, always stated that he believed his son was abducted by a UFO, and I can't blame him for thinking that way, because that would mean he was still alive. Unlike most UFO stories, you can't just be cynical and dismiss this one, because there is a victim here, a man who has been missing for nearly 40 years, and he still has surviving family members who want to know what happened to him. But until conclusive evidence surfaces, I don't think we'll ever know the full truth, and I would not be surprised if the most famous event to occur on my birth date will always remain an unsolved mystery. All that being said, should you happen to have any information which sheds light on the unsolved disappearance of Frederick Valentich, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. So before we close things out, I'd like to send out another special thanks to my Aussie friend Cambo for doing a tremendous job at providing the voice of Frederick Valentich during our recreation of his final transmission. Like I mentioned earlier, Cambo hosts his own podcast called True Crime Island, and if you've never heard of it, here's a promo.
Do you get mad when listening to true crime? Well, so do I. If you want a weekly true crime podcast that says what you're thinking, then grab a beer and pull up a deck chair. This is Cambo from True Crime Island, another true crime podcast, and maintain the rage with me. Visit truecrimeisland.com where you can download or stream each episode, plus there's links to iTunes and social media. Don't forget to delete your browser history. This is True Crime Island.
I want to thank all my loyal listeners and supporters out there, especially those from the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. We also had a new donation this week from a listener who wishes to remain anonymous, but I still want to say thank you very much to them. You know who you are. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode and has provided some fantastic, spooky new tracks this month for our Halloween episodes. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. We also have a Facebook discussion group, so if you feel like discussing the podcast or the cases we feature with myself and your fellow listeners, feel free to join, and I'll approve your entry into the group ASAP. Like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website, so if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. And most importantly, since this episode is being released a couple days before October 31st, I want to wish everyone out there a happy Halloween, and I hope you've enjoyed the Halloween-themed stories I've selected to cover this past month. But just because Halloween is over, doesn't mean that the mysteries are going to get any less creepy, as I've got some very interesting cold cases lined up for November. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new mini-sode of The Trail Went Cold.
We'll be right back.